Hello listener, and welcome to our final episode of 2016. It's the second of Not Enough Champagne's end of year reviews. If you want to listen to the first one, which was a review of British politics in 2016, you can find that on our website, notenoughchampagne.com, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. Now, this was recorded a few weeks ago, so it was recorded before we knew the results of the French Republican Party's presidential primary. Now, in that election, the favourites, Alain Juppé and Nicolas Sarkozy, they were beaten in an upset victory by the Gaullist candidate François Fillon. We'll be talking about that probably on our website and in future podcasts next year. Also, we talk about François Hollande. François Hollande said that he's not going to stand for the Socialist Party in their primary system. So there's going to be a French Socialist candidate announced in February 2017. Bear that in mind when you listen to the episode. Hope you enjoy it. Listener, welcome once again to Not Enough Champagne, our final episode of 2016. The champagne is now on ice, and we're going to be talking about populism in 2016 and in 2017. So we're going to start by talking about Sanders, Trump and Corbyn, the three musketeers of populism, perhaps. And then we're going to talk about, is Marine Le Pen going to become president of France? One of the things I've enjoyed most this year, actually, is John Dickerson's Whistle Stop podcast. One of the things he talks about is the turning points fallacy. So it's the fact that in a campaign, there's often these things which are seen as great turning points. But often those turning points, they tend to be the moment that trends underneath the surface, they crystallise, and that's when they become apparent. I wonder if 2016 is a good example of that. But are we seeing, and I should probably actually introduce you. This is what happens when you tune in the other day. So we've got Steve Haynes, Part and Propaganda, and Danielle. Back, a third one of Glutton for Punishment. The populism that we're seeing in 2016, not just in Britain and America, but across Europe, we're seeing the Pirate Party in Iceland as well. Is this kind of unfinished business from the economic crisis in 2008, is that the real turning point?
Yeah, I would say it is. The recovery from that crisis is markedly different from previous ones in that it's generally a lot slower. The damage that the crisis did has actually been severe and long-lasting, possibly permanent in some cases. Mix that in with the growing sort of automation in certain industries as well, and increasingly, and increase in certain sectors, you've got permanent loss of jobs, and it's just all culminating this like simmering rage among the people who've been most affected and have just not been able to get back on top of where they were when the crisis struck.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's quite a strong element of truth to the notion that this is almost a delayed reaction to the 2008 crisis. There was a bit of analysis I stumbled across during the Democratic primaries for the US where it was looking at why white Democrats, broadly speaking, were supporting Bernie Sanders, and why ethnic minority Democrats were supporting Hillary Clinton. Ethnic minorities were a lot more bullish and positive about the state of the economy than the white Democrats were. And the reason for this was because for ethnic minorities, the sign of a good economy is, do you have a job or not? Of which, for the most part, they did. The jobs growth has actually been reasonably strong in the US, especially for ethnic minorities in all a lot of the jobs that they would traditionally do. Whilst the white, largely middle class, Bernie Sanders supporters viewed economic security in relation to their pensions and their savings accounts. And those things had not recovered since the 2008 kind of financial crisis. For the rise of a kind of a populist candidate on the left has almost got, at least in some way, down to a lack of returning to what most people would consider to be normal for their own economic condition.
And I suppose it's not just since 2008, it's a longer term trend as well. I mean, we've seen 30, 40 years of neoliberalism where medium incomes have stagnated in Britain and America over the past 30, 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain, especially big companies, I mean, where instead of sort of making more things to generate more profit, they're choosing to cut wages and cut benefits their staff instead. I mean, that's certainly sort of contributed towards the sort of increasing sort of wave of populism you're seeing and sort of anger at sort of big business, which Sanders and Corbyn have tapped into.
We talked about the kind of previous crisis, and I suppose we haven't seen the mass unemployment that we saw, say, in the 1920s, 1930s, almost because we're seeing more self-employment, more precarious work. And certainly the rise of Sanders and the rise of Corbyn is maybe a reaction against the third way policies of the Democrats and of Labour as well.
I'm not necessarily sure that holds as true for the Democrats in the US. I mean, let's be honest, we've got President Barack Obama at the moment. Barack Obama is very much in a lot of ways he is a moderate, but he's still a very solid liberal. He's not a third way in the way that Clinton was. So I'm not necessarily sure that holds true for the US.
I think there's a different sort of kind of anger in the US, whereas it's not so much anger at the economy in terms of among Sanders supporters, it's anger at the big banks, who they perceive as having basically gotten away with murder and have never been sufficiently punished. And you'll see that Sanders tends to focus on going after Wall Street an awful lot, as opposed to actually trying to go after policies that improve people's lives, and became a bit of a one note thing with him. I found
no, whereas in Labour they've not really focused on the bankers. I mean, there was the infamous bank bonus tax, which was going to fund everything federal, but there hasn't really been that kind of mass populist left wing insurgency. I mean, we've seen it a little bit in the Labour Party under Corbyn, but it doesn't really seem to have translated widely. Instead, it's kind of been more of a
confined to the membership, really, because the irony is it's actually as much as the membership's gone and sort of attracted towards a sort of populist movement, it's actually had the reverse effect in the public. It's really reduced Labour's standing in the polls. It's actually actively driving the public away, whereas it's strange because Corbyn and Sanders are both trying to they've got a similar kind of message, but one's turning the public off and one is actually generally did manage to grab the attention of a massive slice of the electorate.
And I think part of that is just down to the different cultures in the US and then the UK. As much as the US political constitution is set up to try and deter extremism of all sorts, I think as a culture they're much more open to kind of radical shifts in thinking. There's a reason actually an awful lot of kind of technological developments actually happen in the US is because they actually tend to foster that kind of innovation, and a lot of their mythos is around kind of those people kind of making the most of themselves. Whilst in the UK we are a much more conservative, and I mean this in actually arguably in a positive way, where it's gradualism. It's evolution rather than revolution. That is the way of things. So that's one of the reasons why Corbyn doesn't get the same kind of traction as Sanders, I'd say, does in the US.
Is it also because, and we talked about this a little bit in our political bullshit episode, where in Britain the narrative that it was Labour overspending that caused the crisis stuck and wasn't really challenged, whereas in America it was seen the bankers caused the crisis. It wasn't George Bush overspending which caused the economic crisis.
Yeah, it was kind of blamed on deregulation as well, and a lot of people I think traced it back to the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act under Bill Clinton. Funnily enough, Bush still kind of got he didn't get the blame for the crisis as such, but it was still, well, this happened under your watch, so therefore this is on you, which is not necessarily fair, and it's certainly not fair in Britain to basically blame Gordon Brown for what went on in 2007, 2008, but unfortunately Labour have never been able to shake that narrative. And
it's because we keep having leadership elections, I think. But Trump's brand of populism is quite different. Like Trump, maybe the nearest comparison to him in Europe is someone like Berlusconi, quite rich, comes from outside politics and becomes the head of this populist movement. The only difference between Trump and Berlusconi maybe is that Trump doesn't own all of the cable TV networks in America.
Yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give it time.
Drawing a comparison between Trump and Berlusconi in a lot of ways is probably pretty accurate. I'm just not entirely convinced that Trump has actually even got the wherewithal to get away with all of the stuff that Berlusconi was able to get away with. I mean, partially that's just down to the fact that the Italian constitution and government is eclectic, to say the least.
You mean dysfunctional?
Yeah, let's go with that. Whilst the US system is very organised, and if it does its job, which, broadly speaking, it does tend to do.
It's interesting there's fine margins as well. I mean, we talked about this in the US election podcast, but if it was 200,000 votes which went the other way, then we'd be talking about President Clinton, and it almost that wave of populism would be ignored, maybe more simmering anger. But how much should we be panicking, do you think?
Not an awful lot, to be honest. I think the problem in the US is there was less like a sudden wave of rush to nationalist populism, as in people actually staying at home. Because if you actually look at Trump's vote total, it's pretty much roughly the same what McCain and Romney got.
Yeah.
So you're not seeing this sudden lurch to the populist right from the US. It's more the fact that the Democrats weren't able to appeal to nearly half the eligible voters. That was 47% of potential voters didn't actually vote. That's where they need to look at, and that's where the messaging needs to go. So I don't think, aside from what's actually going to happen in the next 4 years, in which case we should actually probably be panicking a lot, but in terms of where America's going to go, I don't think we do need to panic too much.
Yeah, there was actually quite a nice take on this on cracked.com of all places, which, yeah, it's not the exact place you normally think to go for political insight. America has not changed. You may be waking up today and kind of going, what happened to my diversity, immigrant-loving nation? And then what he did was he just dived into the polls and says, 57% of Americans now think that weed should be legal. That's new. That's interesting. A majority of Americans think that immigration is a good thing for this country. America as a nation has actually become increasingly more progressive. And that is largely reflected in the actual popular vote. Unfortunately, all of that vote for the Democrats is in California,
yeah.
New York. And, you know, all of the large populous states, they're going to win, and they're going to win them big, and they're going to win them easy. Unfortunately, with the way the Electoral College is set up, they're not going to be able to get, they're not going to be able to win an election just on the strength of votes.
Mm. And I suppose it's different in Britain and the US, where you have got that kind of first-past-the-post system. You've got that two-party system, it's quite difficult to break into, whereas a lot of the other populist uprisings we've seen, people like Syriza in Greece, people like Podemos, the Pirate Party in Iceland, the reason they've been able to be successful is because they've got a more proportional system. It's easy for insurgents to break in there.
Yeah.
What we can talk about then is 2017, because what could possibly go wrong in 2017?
Everything.
Yeah. Francois Hollande, 4% approval rating. That's quite impressive. That's almost like a reverse Stalin, because Stalin would have a 96% approval rating.
It's been a pretty bad year for the left all round, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's been a very, very bad year for Francois Hollande.
For the left in France, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's fascinating what seems to have happened. The reason why he's so unpopular is because he's been giving interviews for a couple of journalists for a few months. The journalist did the unprecedented step of publishing what someone said in interviews with him, which presumably Hollande didn't think they would do while he was trying to still run for president. And it's in a 662-page book. And apparently he calls the judiciary a cowardly institution. Says that the French football team are badly brought up kids.
To be fair.
Calls the poor toothless. He also belittles the education of France's speaker and of his own prime minister. And his own education minister, because they didn't attend the elite civil service college that he did. He also admits to authorising 4 targeted killings by the French Secret Service. And after the book was published, he had to issue 8 letters of apology. Because basically he insulted everyone, nobody is bailing him out. Usually, Manuel Valls, who's his prime minister, usually he's a defender of Hollande. Instead, he spoke of his anger and shame.
What kind of idiot do you have to be to give those statements? What on earth was he thinking when he admitted to ordering targeted killings?
The interpretation from The Economist, where the article was from, is that essentially he's just profound narcissism, basically, overconfidence, that he told the journalist, didn't think that the journalist would report what he'd said in the way that they did, in such a blatantly truthful way.
Yeah.
To be fair, in an age of post-fact politics, the radical truth is clearly...
Francois Hollande is the antidote to post-truth politics this year. So thank you, Francois. Well, it looks like there's going to be a few different people running in the French presidential election. There's going to be Emmanuel Macron, who's a ex-finance minister, who's going to unblock France, which sounds very painful. But
what is it, a decongestant?
Apparently. On the right, and I suppose it presumably, because how the French presidential election works is that they vote and the top 2 candidates go into a runoff. And we assume it's going to be a repeat of, I think, 2000 or maybe 2004, when you end up with the far-right candidate and the Conservative candidate running in the runoff. And so
it's quite depressing when you think about that we're now at the point where the lesser of the two evils has degenerated to the point where it's like, Okay, this really bad Conservative candidate or a complete and out-and-out fascist.
My favourite fact about Nicolas Sarkozy when I was researching this is that in Vanity Fair, he was... In 2007, he was named as one of Vanity Fair's best-dressed men in the world alongside Richard E. Grant and Lenny Kravitz.
Kravitz.
Which goes to show that you can't trust
experts.
There's
no accounting for taste.
I'm wary of making a prediction because I've been spending 18 months telling people who ask me that the apocalyptic thing that they're worried about happening
can't happen,
isn't going to happen, and then it does. So really, I should be going out, I should be campaigning for Marine Le Pen, I should be knocking on doors and speaking in my best French accent about how people should vote for her.
Good morning, I'm here to speak to you about the Front National.
That would definitely help, wouldn't it? But so I'm going to leave it to you instead. Do you think Marine Le Pen will be French president this time next year?
No, I don't. But then again, I just saw a story recently how French pollsters are saying no, she definitely can't win. And given what the way pollsters have been the last year, that's probably a sign that she will. But I mean, I'd like to think people are, you know, better than that, even though I haven't really got a lot of stuff to back it up this year.
I think we should put that in Latin on Labour's crest. Because
we should be better than this.
We should be better than this, but we haven't got any evidence to prove.
I think ultimately, because I still think she's too... I mean, France has always had that more racist and more bigoted streak than some other European countries. I mean, it's institutionally sexist. It definitely has a problem with racism. I mean, but I still think overall it's not that far gone. The other parts of the electorate, the more liberal left leading side will coalesce around Sarkozy to make sure he wins rather than let the fascist in, as it were.
Yeah, I think that's actually the key thing there, is that France has a history of doing this. It did it with Marine Le Pen's father, when in the runoff it was him versus Chirac. So Chirac versus Le Pen original, and the left got behind Chirac. One of the issues you have with kind of tactical voting is that unless people are used to doing it, they don't like doing it. The French are kind of used to this, and I think they're quite strong. I think a number of them, there's still a notion of Vichy France and that kind of being a betrayal to what France is supposed to be about in their national identity. I think because of that, in that runoff, Le Pen is going to struggle to hit that 50% margin that she, well, not margin, 50% of the vote that she needs. I think currently she's on average in something like 20, the mid to high 20s in the polls now. Okay, maybe those polls could put her at the 30s or whatever, but it becomes very, very difficult to see where she picks up that extra 20% that she needs. At the end of the day, she's got to, if it does boil down to the right wing candidate versus the far right candidate, you know, she's not going to peel it off from the right, and the left are very unlikely to go to her. Now, if something strange happens and we end up with the socialists getting through to the final round, and it's versus Le Pen, that's when things could get interesting, and that's where maybe she's able to find enough, peel off enough things, because the kind of the part of the base that Sarkozy is trying to appeal to is very much the kind of the base that part of France that Le Pen would also want to appeal to get her over the line. As long as it goes, you know, right versus far right, I don't think Le Pen can win. If it goes left versus far right, then I think she has a chance.
That's interesting, actually, because I wonder if it was Hollande against Le Pen.
Oh God!
I'd
be putting literally, I'd put a grand on it right now.
Yeah,
because she would just walk it. Which thankfully it won't be that. Yeah. But that is the odd situation where we want the right to get through rather than the left in that instance. Yeah. Because even though, you know, we might prefer Macron or Valls or whoever as president,
we're pragmatic realists to know that our views are not shared by anyone.
Yeah. You know, as long as we might prefer that, I think another Sarkozy presidency is infinitely more preferable to Marie Le Pen. So.
Yeah, but again, this sort of goes back to something we've been saying in earlier episodes, I think, where the left really doesn't seem to be able to combat the far right or the further right these days very well. And we're kind of like depending on the right to sort of be a bulwark against sort of the worst elements on its side.
Mm.
And it's something the left really is going to have to learn to deal with, and if it's actually going to actually sort of recover from the losses it's sustained this year.
So moving on then to another case of impotent left-wing party versus mainstream right-wing party versus batshit insane far-right party. Let's go on to Germany and the German election. There's German elections as well this year. Wow.
Yeah, the way
I can feel the optimism.
Yeah, I mean, Germany at the moment is quite ironically basically the last man standing for like liberal democratic values. It feels
Obama went to Germany the first country I think after the Trump won, wasn't it? So
yeah.
Angela Merkel seems to be his kind of anointed successor.
Defender of the bastion of democracy and liberalism.
Yeah, she gave an excellent response to Trump's win, by the way, where she basically made him adhering to, you know, basic human decency a condition of, you know, continued relations with Germany.
Well, that's that gone then.
Yeah, but yeah, it's like when you put it like that, it feels like we've got a row of dominoes set up and like the first few have fallen and we're just waiting for France and Germany to fall now.
We're not even going to talk about Geert Wilders in this episode.
I mean, the problem with her is she's had an admirable stance on the refugee crisis, where she's saying, no, these are victims of war, we need to bring them in, because it's our duty, you know, as a democratic liberal country to do this. But there's an increasing tension in Germany, and there's an increasing amount of backlash against that. So I'm quite worried about what that's going to mean for her in the elections.
And it's going to be interesting looking at Alternative for Deutschland, who is an interesting genesis, because they were formed in 2013 as an anti-Euro party. The kind of early members were liberals and academics, and it's a kind of interesting parallel with UKIP, because the guy who founded UKIP was Alan Sked. And I think he was a kind of Whiggish Tory. I might even have been a liberal, but then it got kind of taken over by far-right elements, one of whom, I think the AfD leader in Saxony-Anhalt, André Ponnenberg, said that Angela Merkel was the worst chancellor in German history. Now, I don't want to invoke Godwin's law, but you have to invoke Godwin's law on that, because there was a guy, what was his name?
Arnold?
Arnold.
Adolf, how was it? Adolf. Yeah. Can't remember the surname at all. No. Yeah. But wasn't very good. Managed to start a World War.
Yeah, kill quite a few genocide. People.
Yeah. He's a name that just I thought might get mentioned. If you're looking at like,
yeah, bad chancellors. You'd think Hitler would be up there.
Bad chancellors? Is that Robert De Niro's next film?
God, De Niro was Hitler. The light-hearted comedy sensation of the year.
So Alternative for Deutschland, anti-immigration, their leader, Franka Petri, I think, said that one of the things that she said is that the German police should be shooting at migrants as they're coming into Germany.
Individual.
And in recent elections, I think it was this year, in some areas they pushed the Christian Democrats into third place, certainly in Merkel's kind of heartland, pushing them into third place. How likely is it? We talked about Merkel's support of Syrian asylum seekers having a kind of populist backlash. I mean, how well do you think they might do in the German elections?
If there's any nation which is aware of its history, it's the Germans. I would be very, very surprised to see a full-throated endorsement of Alternative for Deutschland. As a nation, they are very well aware of what happened previously. They are a nation which goes to great pains to ensure that they don't, that future generations do not forget those lessons. Now, that doesn't mean that the AfD can't do well. I would expect them to make gains. I would expect them to potentially be hailed as having a breakthrough moment. But I would not expect this to turn up into some form of position where they're in power or in a government.
I mean, do you think they'll, in Germany, you need a 5% threshold to get seats in the German parliament? Do you think they'll meet that threshold?
5% isn't a lot. If you were to turn around to me and say 5% of any country is racist, I would say yes, absolutely. Yeah. And if they are able to mobilise that vote, along with, you know, a few of the random people who are just along for the ride for other reasons, then absolutely yes, they could probably hit that. It would not shock me that they end up with seats.
Yeah, how many seats though is a question. I can't see them forming enough seats to, you know, actually
influence very much.
Yeah,
No, I can't imagine that they'd be invited into a coalition government.
No.
I think in Germany you'd have a much stronger... If it did even in Germany end up with a case where somehow they'd ended up holding the balance of power, the Germans would probably end up going for a grand coalition rather than bringing them in. Because they have done that before.
I think relatively recently as well. Yeah, I think Gerhard Schroeder was...
So it would not surprise me at all if they basically went, no, we're not dealing with you. We're just going to block you out. You may therefore be the official opposition, but we don't give a shit. You don't have a say on this.
That was 2016 for Not Enough Champagne. We'll be posting some archive episodes and best ofs over the Christmas and New Year period, and we're going to be back in January with a new season all about personal responsibility. In the meantime, if you would subscribe to us on iTunes, if you would leave a review, if you would tell whoever you can, however you can about us, that would be fantastic. If you want to tweet us, I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Cinder Radical.
I'm at Abracadabra.
And no, we're not going to spell that. You're going to have to try and find it out yourself. We'll be with you in the new year. Have a lovely Christmas. God, it feels like a proper radio host. This is great, isn't it? Have a lovely Christmas. Have a lovely new year. We will see you on the other side in 2017.
Bye.
Bye-bye.